C101.5 FM, The Hawk, from Mohawk College in Hamilton, Ontario.
They say we're too far gone. I don't believe that it's true. They say keep on keeping on. I say what else can I do? Jaws of defeat. They say we're playing with fire. I say we don't mind the heat.
Show called Dangerfield on 101.5 FM The Hawk. I'm Mary, and tonight my guest is Sam Roberts. Sam Roberts is a Canadian rock singer-songwriter who has released 7 albums. He's been nominated together with his band for 14 Juno Awards, winning 6, including Artist of the Year twice, Rock Album of the Year twice, and Album of the Year as well. This Friday, October 16th, the Sam Roberts Band will be releasing their new album, All of Us, a work of 9 incredible songs recorded this year. I first saw Sam play 18 years ago in 2002 at a show at the Rivoli in Toronto and have been a fan ever since. Welcome to the show, Sam.
Thank you, Mary. Nice to be here. And congratulations on Dangerfield. It's been way too long in coming that you have your own radio show. So glad that you're finally taking the plunge.
Thank you. Let's start off the show playing a song of yours called Youth off your new album, All of Us, and then we'll come back and we'll chat a little bit more about the album and music in general.
Ooh.
promise and I never want to let it go. Cause you're only young. Try to remember how your heart was beating when you were young.
By Sam Roberts Band. You're listening to 101.5 The Hawk out of Hamilton, Ontario. I'm Mary, and my guest today is musician Sam Roberts. Sam, that song that is off your new album coming out this Friday, October 16th, called All of Us, it really invokes a lot of feelings of beauty, nostalgia, and wonder. Do you remember the music that you first connected to as a kid?
For sure. I mean, I started off playing classical violin. That was my my parents, basically, when I was about 4 years old, they said, you have to learn how to play an instrument. And I don't know what made me choose the violin. I had no idea that the instrument was going to torture me, basically, for the rest of my life. But they came home with this violin, and I started taking lessons. And I really fell in love with classical music to start with. And for sure, even when I, you know, to this day, when I sit down and start writing my own music, I think that's the music that I kind of go back to first. Mm-hmm. And then from there, my dad's rock and roll. My dad had a great, he still does, except that I've stolen a lot of the great records from it for mm-hmm. my own collection. But he had this great collection of LPs, and I would sit down. And of course, it's like a wood paneled record player. And he had every Pink Floyd record, every Bob Dylan record, all the Beatles records. And I think in terms of like finding rock and roll and finding the music that sort of, I guess, sparked my imagination when it came to eventually writing my own songs, picking up the guitar and wanting to make music a bigger part of my life than just playing the violin in my bedroom. It was those records. And it was glad that my dad had such an eclectic sort of you know, collection and taste in music.
And how old were you when you wrote your first song? And was it on violin or was it on guitar?
I used to try to write music on violin and it was really, really terrible. Once in a while, I'll come back, you know, across like some attempt at a violin concerto that I would, you know, tried to write when I was six, thinking that, well, if Mozart did it, then I should be able to too. And clearly that wasn't the case at all. But I started writing my own songs with my cousin Danielle Duval, who you know well, and we kind of became like the sort of default family entertainment. And we used to get together a lot when she lived in Montreal. We had this big family, and music was always sort of at the heart of every gathering. And Danielle and I kind of took over the reins as the sort of as the jam band, and we would learn Beatles songs and Rolling Stones songs and Pink Floyd again, and then one day, I don't know what, I think that's the hardest thing to answer is what was the first impulse, like what made you think that it was a good idea for you to write your own song, like and where does that come from? And I still don't know quite the answer to it, but I do remember it was a song called Moon Child. I mean, I can't, you know, I won't even sing. I can't sing. It's so bad that it's embarrassing. Even, you know, even though I wrote it as a kid, I can't sing. I can't get myself to sing the words. If you ask Danielle one day, she might tell you some of how, but yeah, it was really, really bad. So again, that's like part two of the question is like, if you write such a bad song, and I knew it was bad at the time, what makes you want to write another song?
And get better.
You know, it's just, I know, but you don't sense the improvement because the second song is only just marginally better than the first one. And like, it, you improve so sort of incrementally, like it's hard to know why you just want to keep going. And I think to this day, that's a kind of mystery that I've never quite fathomed is what makes you want to keep doing it when you're, when you don't really particularly like what you're doing.
And you're bilingual, right? So was English or French your first language?
English, for sure. English. My parents are from South Africa and still to this day barely speak French. Sorry, Mom and Dad. I know you're trying.
And have you ever written a song where you think first about the words in French, or have you only ever written songs in English first?
No, for sure. I think it's funny because I never could write a rock and roll song in French, but as soon as you put sort of a dance beat behind it, all of a sudden you start thinking in French. So there's a song which I very unoriginally called French Disco back in sometime in the mid 90s, and dance music had essentially swept rock and roll right off the map in Montreal. Mm-hmm. It wasn't necessarily the case in Toronto, but for sure at home it was all club music all the time. So I figured, oh, what the hell, I'll give, you know, why not take a shot at writing some dance music? So yeah, put a little disco beat, and next thing you know, all the words started coming out in French. So it's kind of a funny thing. You don't really know when it's going to happen, but sometimes, yeah, it's just French words will just seem that much more appropriate for the music itself.
Interesting. And so you have a very long history with your bandmates. You've known Jimmy since high school, correct? Your bass player?
Earlier? Since elementary school, yeah.
And so you had a band before Sam Roberts' band called, I think it was called William First, then it was called North Star. And I actually have a copy of that album, and it's got some really great songs on it. Have you ever thought about playing those songs live at a show?
We still do once in a while at a rehearsal or something. We'll just start playing because it was James, Eric, and myself who sort of were in that band right out of high school. It's kind of like, just to go even a step further back, like James and I met in kindergarten, basically.
No way.
And we had rival BMX bike gangs. And he had a Leader, like the brand name was Leader, and I had a Rally And so we were, my friend Mike and I were the Rally Brothers, and James and his friend Pete, we called them the Leader Losers. So it's amazing that we're still speaking to each other, considering, you know, our beginnings. But somehow in high school, you know, you just gravitate towards the people who are into the things that you're into, you know, mm-hmm. We were into playing in a band from the very beginning. And we went to a Catholic boys high school. So we had a uniform, and the challenge became, how can you make your uniform sort of reflect your musical leanings?
Right.
So I think we all kind of opted for mod. Like, the easiest thing to do was just to go try to look like, you know, the Who in, you know, early days, or the Jam. And there were a lot of, like, then there'd be some guys who were like really into the Specials, and they would kind of like go a bit more on the ska route. But eventually you kind of came to know all the people who were musicians just by the way they kind of adopted the uniform, so to speak.
It's so funny. I was just thinking of that, because I went to an all girls school and a Catholic school, and it was the same thing. It was like, I was just talking about this the other day, because I remember we had the same way of just trying to like be unique in a uniform still. And I remember one morning my teacher pulling me up to the front of the class and was like, this is how your uniform is not supposed to look. Because you try and kind of, yeah, modify it and still get away with it without breaking all the rules. But that's cool.
It was a good lesson, though. A good fashion lesson anyway. But yeah, sorry. That was a roundabout way of getting back to your question, is that the stuff from William and North Star, essentially that was all the same band. Mm-hmm. And there was one of the founding members, you know, out of the eighth grade, this is a guy named Michael Juretic, who's one of my best friends. And we kind of started the band together with Danielle. And that was Danielle Duval. That was the original lineup. And then James came in. James was singing kind of in a goth band. And he was singing, which is like, if, you know, crazy to think. But he had this like crazy low kind of baritone goth thing going on in this band called Screwtape Backwards. Which is, actually, I was briefly moonlighting in Screwtape Backwards also. So there were a lot of connections going on in the sort of high school band scene at that time. And then William and North Star grew out of our love for the Smiths and Jesus and Mary Chain and Stone Roses. And that was kind of like where those, I think, the musical sort of underpinnings of those records. And so we did our own version of that kind of thing. And yeah, so from time to time, we'll pull out, you know, a song from the catalog and try to hack our way through it.
And you've actually got a really cool cover that you do. You put it out on your EP, Counting the Days, called Spirit in the Sky. That's a pretty cool cover. What made you want to cover that?
I've always loved that song. And it kind of feels a little bit like a song out of its time, you know. It's actually a very just rhythmically, the way the song's put together, it's almost kind of the way that T-Rex like is a band out of its time. Like, nobody's ever done that again. Just the production on the records and I always felt like that song just kind of always came out of left field, and wondered if we could kind of put our own stamp on it. It's so hard to do when it's such an iconic song, and there's always so much trepidation when it comes to a cover like that, but just kind of threw caution to the wind.
And so for your new album, and for those just joining, you're listening to 101.5 FM The Hawk, and I'm joined by Sam Roberts of the Sam Roberts Band. Your new album that's coming out this Friday, October 16th, called All of Us. What was the first song that you wrote that ended up on that album, and what was the last song?
The first song was Wolf Tracks, which is the first song on the record. but it was the first song that came out. And although I wrote the music for it a few years ago now, and it just sort of sat there as an instrumental for a while. And the danger of that is, if you let something sit instrumentally too long, it becomes really, really difficult to put words to it after, and you have to, you know, it'll tend to reject the way a body rejects an organ, you know, it'll reject words and melody after the fact. And so I kind of tiptoed around that song for a couple of years, trying to find the right spirit for it. And then the last song was All of Us, which became the sort of title track. And that's not the first time that's happened, that the last song you write ends up being the sort of all-encompassing, you know, representation of everything else on the record, because you've had time to kind of figure out what all the threads between the music are and the songs, and what have you been trying to say all this time, and then you kind of, I guess, try to compress it and distill it into one final push. So,
and you recorded this this album in a studio up north, I think, right around the time the pandemic was like really starting, mm-hmm. correct? Like it was like, I guess it was in the start of March, was it, that you recorded it?
Yeah, well, that was the last session. We'd been recording in Montreal for the previous sort of 6 months on and off with Gus Van Gogh and Werner Fritsching, his partner, coming up from New York to produce the record. So we were already pretty well underway, and then we had one last sort of session that we knew we needed to do to kind of finish off the record. And as that was happening, it was sort of late February, and the world was waking up to this new reality. I don't think it had quite settled in, or like what it was going to be and how much of a shift this was going to represent to all of us, but we knew that it was important that we get into the studio and finish it, because we weren't sure when we were going to get the chance. And I think that kind of serves not just this record but any record well. You've given it time, you've sort of sat with the music, you've revisited it, you've you know, gone back and thrown different ideas at the songs. But at some point, a sense of urgency can be a good thing. And we knew that we had about 7 days. So we went into the studio and finished it off.
And what song would you say off of this album had the biggest arc from when you conceptualized it to begin with versus what it ended up being by the end on the album?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, All of Us was the song that, you know, I say I wrote it last, but actually it's sort of the beginnings of that song existed for a couple of years before. And it was originally called Death Eater, because I'd been reading Harry Potter to my kids for 7 years. And it was basically the only thing that I could think of at that point. So, but then I tried writing a song, and like everything that came out literally was a Harry Potter reference. I was like, I can't put out a full-blown Harry Potter song, man. So I changed, you know, that. So that was probably like the wildest swing in theme and tone, for sure.
And so has having kids and kind of revisiting like books, or maybe books that you read in your childhood, and kind of reintroducing your kids to that, have you found that that's kind of influenced some of your writing style, maybe? Like, does it make you look at the world in a more magical way at all?
Yeah, I think that's a good way of looking at it. You know, I'm on to the Lord of the Rings, which is sort of, it was one of the things that made me fall in love with Led Zeppelin, was that all the Lord of the Rings references, I was like, wow, finally a band is speaking to me.
Yeah.
And my nerd heart, you know, in such a heavy rock and roll way. I was like, wow, this is like, but I think anytime you can reconnect with, what it's like to be a kid helps to sort of loosen up your imagination, for sure. And you know, you don't even realize that you're getting set or stuck in a way of thinking. It just creeps up on you, and then you sort of try to push and pull your creativity in different directions, but it doesn't want to go. And I feel like, yeah, seeing the world through my own kids' eyes on a daily basis just helps to keep that creative muscle more limber.
Yeah. And when you write lyrics to songs, like, do you prefer do you like explaining to people what the lyrics specifically mean to you, or do you prefer for people to interpret it and make it their own?
You got you folks on the radio can't see, but Mary and I are on a Zoom call right now. We can see each other, and I'm just like shaking my head side to side as vigorously as I can in response to that question. No, for sure, I find it. It's not just counterproductive. It's sort of it goes against the whole point of what makes a song meaningful to a person is what you find in it yourself, what you see of yourself in it,
right,
that I could never possibly intentionally mean to put in there. And that is what makes a song a good song is that it is open for it to be Mary's song and not just what I say it's going to be. So anytime I have to sort of explain lyrics, I'm all of a sudden cementing
right.
that relationship,
yeah.
and I'm closing off that channel. And again, mm-hmm. Some people see that as like a huge cop out of, you know, and you know, you'll get a lot of pushback against that. But I believe it entirely. I remember there's this great footage of a kid showed up at John Lennon's door and asked him what a song meant, you know, like knocked on the door and like, he was kind of like a little out of it. And there's John Lennon, like this couple of years before he died, like answering the door and actually taking the time to answer this kid's question. He's like, no, man. He's like, I can't tell you that that's what it's about. You know, mm-hmm. I can't say that this is what the song's about. It's like, it's what you feel. And yeah, I believe that completely for sure.
For those just joining us, you're listening to 101.5 FM The Hawk. I'm Mary, and I'm joined by Sam Roberts of the Sam Roberts Band. So then, Sam, when you listen to music, like you're just speaking there about lyrics, and I'm the type of person, when I listen to music, I don't hear the lyrics for like a really long time. Like, and I think that that's just almost like a way to keep music infinite to a certain extent. And then like one day, like something will just jump out at me and like maybe one line or something. Do you have a process, like a way that you hear music that you can identify, or does it just depend on the music itself?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely listen to the music. Again, I come from a sort of instrumental background before I ever tried to put words to music, and I still find that's the most dangerous part of the songwriting process and the most difficult by far. When I write songs, it's always music first, and I just sit and the music just comes out, and there's this incredible kind of rush that comes along with that and this freedom, and you're just sort of exploring sounds and ideas and rhythms. And then you get to this point where it's like, okay, the music's there, it's sitting in front of you, and now you've got to put words to it. And then everything just comes screeching to a halt, because there's nothing I hate more than ruining a nice song with words that can't match what it means to me or how it makes me feel. So the process becomes much slower. And then all of a sudden, instead of just kind of chasing this wild boar through the brush, you're now sitting there patiently waiting for the right words. And that part, I just have to, I've tried to learn to just be a bit more calm and measured about it, and wait for the right thing to come and work through it. And then when it's there, if it's there and you've done it well, it'll bring the song to a better place.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's nothing worse than feeling like you've taken away from a song by the words that you've, you know, thrown at it.
You know, kind of a song. So you had an interesting experience, I would say, this year. So We're All In This Together became this kind of rally cry around the pandemic globally. Like this, the words All In This Together, people were saying and to keep their spirits up. And then, you know, it's also the name of a song of yours off your album, Low Fantasy. What was that like to kind of see something that was from a previous time really kind of get people through the current time, and how did that, it almost became an anthem, I would say. What was that experience like?
Yeah, I mean, it was a bit, I don't even want to call it a coincidence, because I didn't make up the saying, we're all in this together, yeah. You know, I just put it to a song, and that was 2013, I guess, that the song was written. But there were things going on in 2013 that seemed to require that kind of togetherness too, or rally cry to pull together in order to push forward. Mm. And I have a feeling that in 2027, we'll need not necessarily that song, but those words to mean something to us again, and probably before then, in order to confront some other thing. And it just is, it in my mind, a universal sort of truth that the individual can just never be as strong as the collective. And it's we're taught to think so differently, you know, we're taught to think the opposite and to just sort of focus on ourselves all the time and our own needs and our, you know, and you get so caught up in that you forget that by sort of joining forces with the people next to you, that you can actually confront and solve just about any problem. And that's what that song was supposed to be. So yeah, it meant something in 2014, but it should apply to any time we need that kind of thinking.
Cool. So isn't it true that you have like a book where you've kept track of every show you've played and every set list?
Not every set list, but I've counted every single show. Yeah. I don't know why. And then like once you've done a few hundred of them, then yeah. then it becomes this obsession.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'll wake up in a panic and I'll be like, oh my God, what was it? What show was it? That was it, you know. So yeah, I know all of them.
And so, what do you know? What your total is, or is it
Of official Sam Roberts Band shows? It's 1,121.
Wow, that's amazing. And so, do you ever like take a day that we're at, like if it's like October 14th, like do you ever go and look back and like on October 14th this year I was doing this?
Like here we, yeah. I mean, it's not. It's pretty amazing, especially since we live in the age of digital cameras, right. And that too, that you can kind of go back and for sure somebody's taken a picture or two of just about any day that we've ever been on the road. Yeah. So you look back and the funny thing is you don't think you've changed, man. Like you don't think, you don't think that time's gone by, because there's just this continuity to the story. You know, you're just back on the bus with the guys, another show. And so it's, and yet, even if you look back 2 or 3 years, you're like, holy shit, man, I'm like, things have happened. Like, I don't look like that anymore. I don't know if, you know, I feel like that, but I don't look like that anymore. And oh, look what James was into. Like, look at his fashion story of 2016. I was like, oh my God, I forgot that whole kimono, like eye makeup thing. I was like, what happened to that? You know? And so, yeah.
That's awesome. So do you have, like, of all your travels, like, do you have any kind of, like, collectibles or nostalgia items or, like, just souvenirs that you've picked up on the road that mean the most to you? Can you think of anything offhand?
Yeah, I mean, I have, like, a kind of a small collection just to my right over here. One of the things we used to stop at like Husky truck stops all the time, and you just buy random things to just, I bought this lion, like a stuffed lion called Cornelius, who, if you pressed his paw, he would,
that's
his
eyes would, that's my dad.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, there you go. You know, in honor of your dad, but his eyes would light up green.
Yeah.
And I could walk through the bus late at night and then just press his thing and he'd go like, but it was pretty scary in the pitch black.
Right.
And then you have these green lights and this roaring thing. So that was one of my favorite ever. That provided me with hours and hours of entertainment for sure.
And do you have a favorite live moment that you've played over, like in your, with the band?
Oh man, there's so many, to be honest. I mean, so, the ones that you've, think, you know, playing like Sarstock in 2003, with 11 minutes that I've just never forgotten, you know, 11 minutes of my life that I sort of have this very sort of visceral kind of physical connection to still, because I was so not nervous in terms of stage fright, but just like every nerve in your body was just on,
Well, there's got to be, like, I actually rewatched that this year, that performance, and it's like, there's just something about the charge. Like, there just must be, like, some sort of energy force field that comes at you with that many people. Like, it was like, I have a photo of it over here, because my dad went, actually, and I went. So he was, I'll show it to you after, but he went at like 9 a.m. and then didn't leave his spot for the whole day. And just talks, he wrote an article about it, just like the wave of people that like kept coming to this, to the front of the stage. And then I went kind of end of the day, cause I had been out of town the night before for a different concert in the States. And we bumped into each other on the way out. And it was like, I think, was it like a million people? Like it was an insane
half
amount.
A million people.
Half a million people. Yeah.
At which point you can see the earth starting to curve. Like you can't even see the, you can't even see the whole crowd. It was unbelievable. And I don't know, like we played so fast that day. Like everything was just set to punk rock speed. And it was like, no matter how hard we tried to sort of be cool and, you know, just reserved, it was just, everything just came out at this sort of frantic speed. So yeah, when I say 11 minutes, we had 15 minutes, but we only took 11.
We were
so nervous about the clock. Like they had this big clock with like, don't go over. And you're thinking of all the people who are going to be pissed off at you, you know, all the way up the chain to like Angus Young and Mick Jagger were going to be mad at you if you went over your time. So we were just like, just get it done as quickly as you can. So yeah, we were done in 11 minutes and we walked off and everybody was like, what, you're done? You have time for another? We're like, nope, that's all. Sorry, we got to go.
That's wild. And so now with the I'm so sorry, for those just joining us, we're listening to 101.5 FM Mohawk and I'm joined with Sam Roberts. And so Sam, so you've played, so since the pandemic started, you've played 2 drive-in shows, I think. One in Toronto recently and one in, I think it was Ottawa. And so what's like, does that feel kind of dystopian? Like what's that experience like? Or, I mean, one of the funniest things I thought was when you were doing like your crowd, speak at the last one, you're like, everyone in the Subaru, honk your horn. So like just having to kind of adapt even to like make that connection. So what was that? What's it like, or is it just something that you're rolling with because like that's the way that you can play live now these days?
Yeah, it's a bit of everything. I mean, that moment was awkward because there was only one Subaru in the crowd. I don't know if you remember, like, what are the chances of there only being one Subaru in a crowd of 400 cars? And sure enough, that was the night where, so there's just like this one lonely honk on the Subaru. And but yeah, I mean, you're just kind of rolling with it. And the Ottawa Blues Fest was the first one that we played in the middle of the summer. And same as with Toronto, we were just so happy to be, we just didn't know for so long when we were going to get a chance to be on stage again. And just that feeling of getting up there with the guys and it's so familiar. It's hard to say, you know, it's just something that we've done so many times, but there was just this, almost like this feeling of awe that we're actually like, somebody was saying, okay, you get to do this again. So it didn't matter about the strangeness of the, you know, the environment or anything like that. It was still just us on stage playing music and knowing that the people behind the windshields were going through the same thing, the same kind of feeling that they also, you know, might have gone to 15 different shows this summer and didn't have a chance and had that taken away from them too. So here was a chance for them to just go and be there, you know, in whatever capacity they could. So it ended up being great. I thought those shows were, you know, we'll never forget them for sure.
Right.
And, you know, if you ask me that same, you know, what's the most memorable memory, whatever, in 5-10 years from now, I bet these shows will come back to mind for sure.
Definitely. And so you've put out 3 songs off your new album so far. I like the way you talk about the future, ascension, and youth. And so your album comes out on Friday. Do you have the next single planned that you're going to be releasing, or is that a surprise?
I don't know if it's a surprise, but, you know, I mean, I think I'd like to put all of us just because it's so emblematic of again, the spirit of the record. And it's also, you just want to put out songs that you feel are, I don't want to say useful to people, but a song that you can latch on to that, that kind of helps clear the fog a little bit. And mm-hmm. right now there's so much fog everywhere in our lives that I want to put out just kind of the most hopeful song for people to have. And we'll see what happens on Friday. But more than anything, I think, you know, this record is an album, and it's meant to be heard kind of from start to finish. And you and I have gone back and forth on what that journey ought to be, you know, because yeah. we're close friends and we've talked about it. How do you create that sort of that arc that takes people from, you know, yeah, I guess on a journey, for lack of a better word, from the start of a record to, you know, and that's still ultimately how I want people to hear and experience these songs. That's how it was made. And that's what it was meant to be. So I know I can't ask that of everybody, but that's kind of what the intention was.
Well, I think that's the beauty too of the vinyl resurgence, is that mm-hmm. It's because, you know, I think vinyl now outsells every other format for new music, because I think that people want that connection, because I think when people are just exposed to a song digitally one at a time, it's like, it's kind of taking away from maybe another message that's meant to be told with an album. And I think the beauty of vinyl is that, you know, you put it on and then you just sit and you listen. Like, you mm-hmm. can't, like, you could skip, but it's easier just to listen. So yeah, I think it's a beautiful album. I'm really excited for people to hear it. And
thanks, man.
Yeah, it's going to be good. So so do you have a favorite record of all time?
Of what?
Not your band, but like any band.
Oh, thank God, yeah. Oh, man, that's a hard question.
Or maybe like I guess, I don't know. Maybe not favorite record, but kind of like the classics that you both.
I can pick four records off the top of my head that I think mm-hmm. are, you know. The Revolver, Beatles, mm-hmm. the Smiths, Strange Ways Here We Come, Paul Simon, Graceland, mm-hmm. Stone Roses debut record.
Thanks.
Screamadelica, by Primal Scream. That kind of gives like the whole,
yeah.
I don't know. Oh, well, Power Man and the Lola versus Power Man and the Money Go Round by the Kinks. So that to me. Oh, and oh my God, I got to put a Bob Dylan record in there for sure. Blood on the Tracks. Blood on the Tracks.
So, yeah, you actually do a beautiful Bob Dylan cover song called Dark Eyes.
Yeah.
Right. And that was on a movie. Yeah, that's a beautiful song, and that really, you really add your own flair to that. I think we should listen to that on the show too. Yeah.
Gentlemen are talking, and the men
They tell me that revenge is sweet. From where they stand, I'm sure.
That's off the record of his lesser known record, Empire Burlesque. But I love that song. And I don't know, anytime you know, we were talking about lyrics before, if you ever want to sort of just figure out where the bar is, you just put on a Bob Dylan record. It's like, oh yeah, I have to try harder. Oh yeah. There's another place I can go, or there's another dimension that needs to be explored here. And I mean, it's an impossibly high and unattainable bar, but it's important to kind of reconnect with it. I find the same thing with Paul Simon and his words, but also the way how rhythmic and musical his choice of words are. I also find that's a really important sort of place to go back to.
So what was that album when you heard Graceland, like with your South African, you know, like what was that like in your family when that album came out? Because your family's South African, did it blow your guys' minds? Was it, how did you react to that?
Oh, man, yeah, it just floored everybody. Yeah. It basically was the only record that was played, you know, when it came out, 1985 or 84, 85. I think for 2 years, it was the only album played in our household. And we used to take these epic drives to Florida at the end of every school year. My dad would drive like 37 hours nonstop and like listening to Graceland the whole time. So, I think it just made us feel more. It's always hard when your family lives on the other side of the world and you don't get to see them. And, we got to a point where three brothers, were four boys, and we just couldn't travel there as much as I did when I was younger. And so it just kind of made us feel there with our family. And again, just a crazy musical journey. And I think aside from my sort of personal connection with the place, musically the kind of thing that still blows my mind, just you know, how not just Paul Simon, all the people involved could concoct that kind of journey on a record.
And so when you traveled there as a kid with your family, like what was, like did you pick up like local music? Like how did you take in the music of the place while you were there?
My dad's, it was funny because my dad's generation, my dad was really, again, for them, getting a Beatles record or getting a Bob Dylan record was, and it was hard to come by. So they treasured those records. For my dad, Hawkwind too, like he fell in love with Hawkwind and, you know, sort of psych rock in the early 70s. And so that was his thing. And his brother, my dad's brother, got really into like African music. That was also taboo at the time. So music coming out of Soweto in the late 60s and early 70s was not something that you found in every sort of white household's record collection. So that's where I started to listen to what my favorite is, Mush Latini and the Mahatela Queens, Miriam Makeba, and that started to find its way. This amazing jazz artist, Dollar Brand, who was making sort of South African infused jazz music, and I still put that record on all the time. And that was kind of finding its way into my life and kind of getting all mixed up in there. I think the music that you hear as a young kid, especially when you're in a place like South Africa or, you know, on the other side of the world, leaves a very distinct mark on you. And not even to this day, I can't write music without kind of going back there in terms of rhythm and melody. And
did you find, like, I know that when we, like, my parents are from Ireland and we used to spend our summers in Ireland, and they were always like a couple years behind in like movies. Yeah. Did you find that? So like we'd go there and it'd be like E.T.'s just coming out, and it had been like, huge. Like,
oh wow. Yeah.
Is it like that in South Africa as well?
Yeah, very much so. But then it would have its other sort of, on the other side of it, they would get things that just never came out. And one of those things that I think the whole world found out about was Rodriguez a couple of years ago. So while that album Cold Fact was literally up there on a pedestal next to the Beatles and the Rolling Stones records, the rest of the world, it was only sort of living in South Africa at the time. And so it kind of had a reverse, and the same thing for a lot of the African music. You couldn't, it was very difficult to access it. And, you know, luckily, I think people found out about it and took an interest in it and started cataloging it and recording it. There's an amazing studio in Zimbabwe called Shed Studios, and they made these incredible records. Another group of bands that I'm super, anything on Shed that comes out of Shed Studios, for sure, I'm going to pick it up. You know, it doesn't exist anymore, I don't think, it kind of had this cutoff phenomenon where it wasn't necessarily being kind of directed culturally by the rest of the world. And because of that, really interesting things tend to come out of places like that. You know?
Awesome. Well, Sam, thank you so much. We're coming up on time here, and I'm conscious of your time because you no doubt have a bunch of interviews you have to get done. But I wanted to thank you for joining me tonight on my show. And I look forward to, for those just listening, it's Sam Roberts, his new album, All of Us, comes out this Friday, October 16th. And I encourage everyone to check it out. So thanks so much for your time. And
well, Mary, thank you for having me on. And to everybody listening, I know that I'm leaving you in good hands, because there's nobody who cares more about music that I know of than Mary. So I'm really, really glad that you have your own radio show, and that you get to share your dedication and passion with all the listeners out there. So keep going.
Okay. Thank you so much, Sam. Take care.
Bye for now, Mary. Bye. Say hi to your sister. All right. Bye.